This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you're at in the U.S. or around the world. Welcome to Baseball Outside the Box. Hey, folks, thanks for joining us. We are over, as we always tell you, over 100 countries, coaches, players, and players listening. We want to thank all of you. Special thanks and, you know, and aloha to ESPN Honolulu for joining us. We are so honored to be on their website having our show with all the shows on ESPN Honolulu. So thank you so much, folks. And we are going to get started. Speaking of Honolulu and Hawaii, we've got a great guest today from that area. And he grew up there, was born there, went to school there. Then he came to the mainland. I almost said U.S., folks, in the mainland. And in the mainland, he went to college. I say high school, but it's K through 12 in Honolulu. Seventh year head coach at Punahou High School, I'll call it for right now. He graduated from there. He won the state title in 2019. That was the first time they did it in 2010, but he did it in 2019. Played at McAllister in Minnesota. And he also coached at McAllister. And something interesting we're going to talk about, he's a pilot with Hawaiian Airlines. And I bring that up because being a pilot, man, you talk about dealing with pressure and training. And we're going to talk about how that relates to working with players. So let's not waste any time. Let me welcome Keenan Sue. How are you doing, Keenan?
I'm good, Pete. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
First thing I'm going to test, I said your last name correctly and I said Punahou correctly, right?
You're pretty much local. By now, that was great.
One on one. All right. I'm doing good so far. Hey, listen, thanks for joining us. And I think it's going to be a special day here because we're going to talk about, you know, of course, we're going to talk about baseball in Hawaii. We've had a couple sessions on it and it's amazing the players that come out of there. But before we do, let's talk about your career, you know, growing up in Hawaii as a little kid. Talk about growing up, you know, and playing baseball there as a little kid, some of the coaches maybe that influenced you, that, you know, helped you become a better player. You were a shortstop. Talk about that, and then we'll get into some more things.
Yeah, sure. A little bit to unpack there. Gotta thank my dad. I mean, in Hawaii and in the era we grew up, we didn't have smartphones, right? So if we were bored, we threw a ball against the wall or went to the park with our dads or moms. And my dad spent a lot of time with me at the park, and he wasn't a ball player. He just asked his buddies. And I wasn't much of an athlete either. We just had to work hard. So a lot of time spent at the ballpark, a lot of reps, a lot of tears, and had some really good youth coaches in one of the local leagues here. And then once getting to high school, Punahou's got a lot of great alumni who come back and want to pay it forward. So we've always had a lot of players who become coaches at Punahou, and the culture's strong and the fundamentals that are taught are sound. And so I grew up in that environment. Had a chance to play for a great man, a couple of great men at Punahou, the Eldridge family, two coaches in particular, Coach Dave Eldridge and Coach Pal Eldridge, ran the program for well over 40 years. And the two of them, along with one of our current coaches, Eric Kusunoki and Galen Kitamura, all of these guys were coaches and players from the 1960s and 70s all the way to now. So those guys really cared about us. I think that old adage, nobody cares what you know until they know that you care. They really cared about us. And that really had a big, big effect on how we played the game and then how we started coaching the game. So I got a chance to play on the mainland, went to McAllister, played for Matt Parrington. Coach Parrington has been there for a long time, over 20 years, and he's been a mentor and a friend. And a lot of what we do at Punahou is informed by all of those guys. We're just really blessed to have been given the opportunity to play the game at a bunch of different levels.
You know, what's interesting is as I talk to everybody in Hawaii about the game, I'm learning more and more about how baseball's been developing there. We all know, and we're going to get into that, you know, all the big leaguers that are playing, college players. I mean, we're talking about, you know, Colton Wong, some great players. Now, not a state with – the population is not huge. I believe it's 1.5 million or something like that. And I always wonder – I look at Cuba in some ways. It's got 11 million people, only 60,000 players in Cuba, not a lot. They compete worldwide with the best in the world. But yet, you always have to ask yourself, you know, they're not able to compete against other countries, other areas. And in Hawaii, you're competing amongst yourself. Well, the competition is has to be really good for these players to become pretty good. Is that a true fact?
You know, I would say there's a little bit there. You know, Hawaii doesn't have the players that California and Texas and Florida does. Right. So, I mean, right off the bat, we don't have that many guys. But per capita, we have a lot of good players. And I think part of it is cultural, part of it is biological. And those two things are kind of tied together because we do have a lot of players of Asian descent in Hawaii, just because of the population demographic. And by nature, unless you're Shohei Ohtani, most of us aren't really that big. And so when you're not the biggest, fastest, or the strongest, you've got to be more efficient. You've got to have really strong fundamentals to be able to execute. It's a tough game. Right. So our boys and gals learn to play the game with a greater focus on the smaller things, I think, earlier, because they're just smaller. And so you got to do it right if you're not that big. And as a result, those fundamentals are pretty strong. Then whenever they go off to college and they play for bigger programs, or they happen to be a guy who's a pretty big dude, that solid base of fundamentals combined with the growth and the strength that naturally comes when you get older, translates into what you see in the MLB today. And those guys are at the tip of the spear, right? I mean, all of those guys that you named are tremendous ball players, and we're all very proud of them for representing the state. But there's a host of other guys who don't make it to the bigs who are all really good players and then have become really good coaches because they had to find a more efficient and better way to do it. And so they may have not been MLB stars or college Division I stars, but we got a lot of guys out here who really know what they're talking about. Because their dads and their coaches passed it on to them.
Hey, folks on Facebook, thanks for joining us. If you have any questions, type them in the comments section. Love to have some questions from you, Keenan. And, you know, Keenan, the other area here I'm thinking about is, you know, a lot of times, you know, we're talking about fundamentals. You know, I'm a little worried because in the U.S. in general, we seem to be getting away a little bit from the fundamentals, wanting to play a lot of games. Now, I get the part about games, but I always wonder, you know, I always say if we focus really strongly on fundamentals with young kids, I mean, could you imagine these kids that are big and strong, if they had really strong fundamentals when they were young kids, didn't wait till they were 18 or 19 to try to develop those, how much better they might be?
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry if you weren't done there. I think when you talk about, you referenced Cuba and you referenced Hawaii as kicking out a bunch of good ball players. I do think the guys you see in the MLB had both of those. They're both big and strong and fat, all of those things. They got all the five tools. Plus they were steeped in that culture of, hey, let's have really good fundamentals from the start. So I think that's why you see so many, you know, Dominican type players in the big leagues, is they've gotten that from the beginning. Plus they have the God-given ability. And as our boys are coming along here, that they're getting the same. So I think you're going to see more and more Hawaiian kids in the minor leagues and in the major leagues as the years come.
Talk to our coaches in the U.S. and around the world. You mentioned culture. Talk about certain areas when it comes to culture that you guys are developing there that would help other coaches in developing players long-term?
Let's see. When you're talking in the context of, say, building a program or just building a complete player, I guess.
Yeah, I think kind of both, but let's start with the player, you know, building a player, you have to start young. You know, an example would be, you know, people say, well, kids aren't hustling. Well, hustling because we're not training them properly how to hustle, you know, And it should be part of the culture where you know, I know I have systems in place where I have fun with the kids where, you know, I don't just say, hey, you got to hustle. I mean, that's just a comment. You know, somebody might say, you know, hustle is easy. Just do it. You don't need talent, but you have to create habits too. You can't just say hustle and they're going to hustle, you know, 100%.
Yeah. I think you hit on something key there, Pete, is habits are everything. And anything you do create is habit forming. So, you know, consistency and greatness is just little things done well day after day after day. I can't take credit for that. I think Ray Lewis said that. The whole concept of discipline over motivation, I think, is key. Once the kids get to a certain age, now when they're kids, they just want to run around and have fun. So I think the fun and the love obviously has to come first, or they're not going to want to do it. And so it would behoove most dads and coaches to remember that when kids are 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, they probably shouldn't be getting screamed at and domed up with all kinds of like technical cues. Many a player has been turned off from the game because of that. Mm-hmm. So I think the fun and the love has to come first. Once they decide it's something they want to do, then it's your job as a parent to, you know, instill a little mental toughness, which is basically, hey, do what needs to be done when it needs to be done, regardless of how you feel. And that choosing that discipline over motivation, because not every kid wants to go field ground balls at the park. It's pretty boring. But if you're a parent who's into giving your kid the skills that they're going to need to succeed, not just in baseball, but in anything, you're going to have to do some stuff that you don't want to do. And it sounds easy, like, hey, work hard, don't worry about it. But that there's a balance. I got young kids, and I coach high school kids, and I coach college kids. And you see varying degrees of discipline and motivation and accountability. A lot of it has to do with upbringing. What'd you get at home? Did your parents hold you accountable? Did they push you just the right amount and love you just the right amount? So we're all making mistakes. I mean, most of what we do in our program, most of what I do with my son and daughter is a product of making like a lot of mistakes. And in that sense, you know, having that ability to say, okay, well, I screwed up. How do I learn from it? I think is key for any coach who aspires to be the best they can be, is just keep learning. And every opportunity, every event is an opportunity to learn and grow and get better.
Absolutely.
I mean, I know that's like coach speak, but honestly, it's like, dude, you're going to fail. And that's the best part about baseball, is that you're winning or you're learning. It's not, you know, wins and losses, W's and L's. It's like you're winning and that's great. It's a validation of your efforts, or you lose and you learn something from it.
You know what?
I don't know. Did I answer? Yeah.
No, that was fantastic. And I should have, first of all, complimented you on your shirt that fits perfect in Hawaii and that beautiful background you have there. That was awesome. Hey, when you talk about learning talk about some of the mistakes that players make and how you use that as a learning process.
You know, I don't know if players are making mistakes. I mean, that whole Karate Kid thing, right? No bad student, just a bad teacher.
Yeah.
And so kids are just kids. I mean, they just very simply, like, they want to be good. They want to make the team. They want to play, and they're selfish because they're kids and they don't know any better. And so it's our job as parents and coaches to kind of meet them where they're at. I think in our generation, it was like, hey, do it. And if you don't do it, next, right?
Yep.
If I say jump, you say how high. It's not like that anymore. And so I think it's probably always been the proper way to coach people, is to kind of care about them as a person and kind of meet them where they're at. And you don't coach every kid the same way. You can't, if you want to get the most out of them. I mean, I guess you could. And some guys do that and it works, because the other side of the coin is that they're trainable, they're malleable, and they will fall in line eventually if they are forced to. And they're
you there, Keenan? Hang on, folks. We took a little break. Had some technical difficulties, but we'll be right back. Keenan, you there?
Yeah, I got you. Sorry, my phone just switched over to my wife's AirPods. Can you hear me now?
Hey, we pick up her conference call. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, that would be.
That's a first one on the show.
You know, sorry.
What I want to talk about is, you know, when you talk about mental toughness, you know, some of the coaches that I talked to in Hawaii seem to suggest that some of the kids, or a lot of the players, not just kids, a lot of players that come out of Hawaii seem to deal with the failure better, seem to have mentally tough players there. Is that a pretty good fact? And what attributes to that, I guess?
That's a good question. You know, I think the players that end up leaving the Rock after high school are by nature the top percent, right? I think that the national average is like 6% of high school seniors go on to play any form of college baseball, NAIA, Division II, III, I, JUCO, anything. So that's a pretty elite group, no matter what. I mean, you're a stud if you play college at all. I don't care what division it is. So I think they're getting the guys who have that built in, because there's a whole host of, you know, 94% of them that don't make it. Not to say that those kids aren't mentally tough or they're not good kids or have grit or resilience, but I think what the mainland is seeing are our best. And that's great, because those kids are mentally tough and they are held accountable. And there is an element of, I think, discipline and probably some cultural and Asian influence discipline here in Hawaii, because a large majority of the population is of Asian descent. Now, most of us are like 5th, 6th, 7th generation. I mean, we're Americans, right? But our ancestors are from Asia. And there is a sense of like filial piety and discipline and accountability that is apparent in those cultures that really is the fabric of our local culture here. So there's that.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, speaking about culture, the first thing I think about all the time is Japan, being there over 30 times. You know, that's one country that I think when you said earlier, you know, you do it and they do it. You know, this is how you do it. No questions asked. I remember going there, giving a seminar to coaches, and I said, anybody have any questions? Well, you couldn't get questions out of them, you know, the very first time I went there. Later, one of the interpreters came to me and said, you know, Japanese coaches don't ask questions. You are the master. And we, you know, they listen to the master and do it. And, you know, and again, that's a culture that they can produce there in Japan because of how they've grown up there. What about your ball club? Talk about what you use to develop culture for your club. What are some of the areas that you work with on your players consistently to develop that good culture for your team?
Well, that's a great question. It starts when they're younger. You know, we get the unique opportunity to have our kids from the time they're 7th grade, so 12, 13 years old, all the way through 18. So a third of their life, you know, and they're easily their most formative years. We have an opportunity to kind of be in their ear consistently and say, hey, you know what, control all the things that require no talent, right? Attitude, effort, hustle, grit, supporting your teammates, positivity, all that stuff. So whether they have it or not, when they come into the program, most of them do, but they hear that all the time. And we have kind of have a saying in our program, like the type of ball player you become is a very little consequence, but how you go about becoming that ball player is everything. Because 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, nobody really is going to care about what your batting average is or what your ERA was or whether you won a state title, but they will remember, was he a good dude? Is this a guy I can count on? Does he have a good work ethic? And because Hawaii is such a small town, a lot of the guys that you play with and against are going to end up being the guys that you see across from the boardroom table, or you're going to go up for a job interview. And how you conduct yourself on and off the field for us is very important, because again, it's a small town and it's sort of self-regulating in that way. So you kind of got to act right, or you're not going to be a guy that people want to be around. So that's what they get from us. It's less about baseball than it is about, hey, just be a good guy. And you know, if you work hard and you do all that stuff, yeah, you're going to get good at baseball, but we're in it for the long game. Because most of the guys are not going to make their living playing professional baseball. So baseball for us, and for me at least, and not everybody I think thinks this way on our staff necessarily. For me, baseball is just the venue to help these guys just be good guys. You know, I know that's cliche, but
no, but yeah. I love that. And I'll tell you why, because what we're doing is And I want coaches to understand that, you know, you're not just teaching baseball, you're teaching life skills. Baseball, you know, you hear it all the time. Baseball teaches life skills. And I mean, when you talk about failure, you know, we know that, you know, and I know people don't like to use the word failure, but unfortunately, if you go up to bat 10 times, okay, you may not fail, but you don't get you don't get 10 hits. You might get 3 out of 10. You might get 2 out of 10. Well, that doesn't happen in other sports. That prepares you for the real life situations. So when one of your players, you know, they're young, they're going to slip up, they're going to make a mistake somehow. You know, they might not hustle, or they, you know, might get real mad, you know, mentally on the mound because they did something, you know, they felt they, you know, they walked the guy, whatever it may be. When that situation comes up, how do you deal with that player? Because I want you to tell coaches in the U.S. and around the world how you deal with that situation.
Yeah, you're talking about, like, you pop up to the second baseman and you're out or something. Yeah. Yeah. The hustling stuff, again, we are really big on, you have to dominate the things that require no talent and doesn't require size and speed and God-given ability. And hustling out, some of that is eyewash, you know, like hustling out a ball to a foul ball. Like, if a ball's foul, you don't need to run that one out. Right. But if it's in fair play, heck, you better run it out. I mean, they could drop it. But if they don't, right, they strike out or they walk 3 or 4 guys and they get pulled out, I don't think it's reasonable to expect that they're not going to be upset, and their kids, right? And they're going to be emotional about it. And what we tell our kids is, look, you have every right to be upset. You can't control that. Go to your little corner of the dugout. Please do not throw your equipment. That's unacceptable, because you do control that. And it's harder for some people than others. But take a minute. Go take a minute. Go close your eyes and take a few deep breaths and be upset. And then the next thing you're going to have to do is get up on the fence and cheer for your teammates. Because at the end of the day, there's only one person who's thinking about your last at bat once it's done. And that's you. The rest of the team is focused on trying to win the ball game. So easier said than done, right? But what we tell our guys, like, hey, once the game starts, in between the chalk lines, it's not about you anymore. It's about us. Now, during practice, on your own time, it's a better me for a better week, right? We're all trying to get better. But once the game starts, like, you give up the right to pout too long. Like, you could pout a little bit, right, in your own corner quietly to yourself. But after that, dude, you better get up and cheer for your teammates. And that's the kind of stuff that we talk about. It's like, how you go about becoming that ball player is everything. That's the kind of stuff that people remember. If you got a guy who's 0 for 4 and they win the game, and you're happy, great. But if you win the game and the guy's 0 for 4 and he's still upset, we're going to have some words about that, right? Mm-hmm. If you're going to pout all the way back on the bus after being 0 for 4 and we just want a playoff game, we're going to have something to talk about. And it's not, for me at least, it's not like yelling at a guy and calling him out in front of everybody. It's just saying, hey, where are you at about this? And if it happens too often, then you know what? You're probably going to find yourself not in the lineup. Your body language is everything.
I think that's something that is changing in the coaching game. And that is, you know, and I always thought about this when I first started coaching and making own baseball school as a young coach. I don't know, maybe my parents, it's the way they taught me. You know, I always had a conversation, you know, I mean, you know, you talk about it, you ask questions to the player, you know, why did you do that? You know, what were you thinking at that time? You know, put it on them to give you that response and let them think about it. So I think that's changed a little bit as a coach. Now, since you started coaching, what are some of the possible 2 key areas that you got better at, that you really learned a lot that are important in coaching?
2 key areas. That's a great question. I've changed. I mean, we've all changed a lot. I think if you're getting better, you're changing a lot. I used to be like, we were raised by the old school guys. And so I used to be a hammer, like an absolute hammer. And then I started realizing that, you know, people don't like being yelled at. having said that, like, my best coaches were the guys who just hammered us all the time. So there's a time and place for that if you have a player who's receptive to that. So I guess the one hallmark would be the willingness to learn and adapt. So that's kind of just a basic paradigm thing. Like, if your worldview is like, okay, I'm humble and open to change, you're probably predisposed to getting better at whatever you do, because the world changes, everything changes. So that's probably one thing. And then I think as a coach of a program that is responsible for 100 guys, and we've been talking about the, you know, like the philosophical aspect, but the X's and O's aspect is important too. I think over time we have identified the parts of preparation and team practice and individual practice that yield the most game results. And so we really focus on those parts of practice. So let's just get good at the things that happen a lot and the things that either can sway a game either way on defense or offense. So we do spend a lot of time on that, that little stuff.
Keenan, what's your coaches' meetings look like? It could be a coaches' meeting after a ball game, maybe even prior to a game. What is that meeting with your coaches? What are some of the areas that you're discussing and preparing yourself for?
Probably shouldn't be mentioning the after coach meetings. It evolves anyway. I'm just kidding. No, you know what? Our communication is very open. I mean, these days you get texts. We're not like sitting there until 10 o'clock at night after a 7 o'clock game is over. Because a lot of our guys have kids and families. So our deal is like, I don't give post-game speeches after, to our players or coaches. It's like, we get back, we get off the bus, and they always have three questions to ask. What'd you do well? What could be better? And how are you going to do it? And they'll text me like, here's my well, better, how. And then that's it. Because usually after you come back from a game, nobody's listening to you anyway, right? You could just go over like your laundry list of things that we need to improve. And the kids are just like, they're not listening. And so I find that after a day of just going and doing whatever they got to do, you come back and we sort of debrief before practice the next day. So what'll happen is we'll play a game. This and this and this happens. This went well. This needs work. Here's how we're going to do it. And then we collaborate with the coaches, work it into the practice plan on our own. Cause we already kind of know, like we're empowering them individually by saying, hey, what went well, what went better, what do you need work on? But we have our perspective as a coach, like, okay, we need to do better bunt defense, or we got to hit our cut man, or, you know, we got to do better on two strike approach. So we're going to work that into the practice plan. And then I have a few key coaches who we formulate the practice plan together. And then we got the template and the spreadsheet, and I disseminate it to the guys and off we go. So, I mean, it's, I guess the other thing that going back to the other question about what has changed is preparation's everything. I mean, that's pretty cliche, but it's important. If you don't plan practice well, you're not going to be prepared for the game. So we always say, like, you can only fight how you train. So we just try to plan well.
Man, I'll tell you what, I'm glad you brought up practice because I'm curious to know what your practice looks like and why some of the key areas of why the things you practice on occur in the game. You know, in other words, you're successful in the game. What type of practice are you running that allows that to happen?
Well, we have an interesting situation because we have four teams and we only have like one field. And I guess I shouldn't complain. I mean, at least we got a field, right? And we have batting cages. So we have covered batting cages, but our field is, the dimensions of it are weird because it's on campus. So we can't hit live on our field. Right field's too short. There's pickups with cars. There's kids walking by. And so it's a liability issue. And we were forced to do that probably about 15 years ago, before I was the varsity coach. They were like, okay, all the administrators are like, we can't do it anymore. Somebody's going to get hit in the head and we're going to get sued. And so we had to adapt how we coach hitting. We had to adapt how we coached outfield jumps. We had to adapt how we coach reading singles off the bat. And that actually, that big obstacle, which we thought was going to be the end of the program, like how do you not have a program if you can't hit live, yeah, ended up being probably one of the best things that happened to us because we had to find creative ways to ID singles, to get outfield reads, to work on double cuts, to work on approach in the hitting cage. I mean, it's like, it was the best thing that ever happened to us.
You know, talk about, let's delve into that a little bit. Talk about what you just said, as far as how do you do those things? What are some of the drills you're doing to accomplish that?
Yeah, well, we work on, giving you the playbook, man. I don't care. It's like, I wish everybody did this stuff. Then we'd all be, everybody would be good. I mean, it's no secret. You know, we work a couple of drills that we work all the time, at least two or three or four times a week, probably almost every day, I guess. We have an ID single drill where we split up the team. We got runners on second, third, and a group hitting, and we just front toss them and they hit the ball. And we have POs, pitcher only's out at position. So the guys know where the guys at, and we just ID singles. as just like over and over and over and over again. And we always talk about being in the battle for 90 feet. So every pitch is a battle for 90 feet, whether you're on the bases, whether you're on the mound, whether you're in the outfield. We're always trying to limit that guy from an extra 90 feet or trying to gain another 90 feet. That whole concept of, you know, winning each pitch, right? We're trying to get at least 90 feet on the next pitch. So that's been great for us. And that's something that doesn't require talent. You just got to work on it. We do a lot of bunt defense. There's a lot of bunting. There's a lot of Asian influence. So we bunt a lot. Everybody bunts a lot in our league. And then hitting wise, we work a lot on approach. We have a full cage. We have a 70-foot cage. And we, instead of our pitchers going to the bullpen and just lollipopping balls to the catcher, we throw live every day. So our guys are getting, instead of just getting like feel good BP from 40 feet at 40 miles an hour, our guys are facing our varsity level pitchers all day long. So we're able to kind of run them through and they'll get four or five at bats. It may be slower, but it's quality. And in a given week, all of a sudden now our guys, even the last guy on the bench who doesn't start, has logged 20 at bats that week. Doesn't always translate. I think we got one hit in the championship game a couple weeks ago, but you know, I think the season, what we found over the years is the season, at least for in Hawaii, it's too short to work on a kid's mechanics. So you can't tell a kid, and we screwed this up, and you know, long ago and recently, we tell a guy to make a mechanical change. It's well-meaning and they just can't make it. The runway is too short because they're trying to do the mechanical change. They're getting domed up by that. Then they're trying to compete and that just doesn't work. And so we try to limit the coaching in the spring to approach and leave the mechanics alone. It's like, hey, you dance with who you brought. Let's just get a pitch you want to hit and pull the trigger.
You know, in your system, obviously you can't recruit players. You know, these are players that go to the school. What's the toughest things as a coach at that level that you have to deal with? What are the hardest things to deal with there?
At the varsity level, you're talking about.
Yeah, the varsity. I mean, you get to pick your freshmen, sophomores if you want to bring them up. But the players are, you get who you have, and you have to work with those players. But that's tough, obviously. It's not like college baseball where you recruit. But there's got to be some difficult things that you have to focus on, the work on to make the players better. What would those things be, maybe?
To help to get them. Okay, wait. So we're talking about difficult things, and then we're talking about what are the things we have to do to get them better. I'm trying to just figure out which one to answer here. You know, we do kind of have a farm system in a way. So by the time they get to us, the guys who make it to varsity have run the gauntlet from, you know, 15 guys in their class, their first time they make it in seventh grade, to, you know, maybe that gets whittled down to 10 to 12 that make JV. And then by the time they get to us, just by the pyramid getting smaller, we're getting 5 to 8 per class. And those 5 to 8 per class are, they got great attitudes. They work hard. They've been in the system, so they know what to expect. And it doesn't mean that we take the foot off our gas with talking about the culture stuff and the accountability stuff, but it becomes like, okay, you're one of our guys. If you made it here, you obviously get it because all the coaches at JV and intermediate have been talking about the same thing. So we don't typically run into a lot of that. There's outliers obviously at times, and usually it happens when somebody doesn't play, right? Because by the time they get to varsity, they've been the best community league player, then they're the best seventh grader, then they're the best eighth grader, then they're the best JV player, and then the first time they ever sit on the bench is at varsity. So it's always the playing time thing. It's always a playing time thing, and it's tough for guys to deal with sitting on the bench. And that's when we tell them, like, hey, look, sometimes the Rolling Stones are right? Like, you can't always get what you want, but sometimes you get what you need. And that adversity, I think, is what you've been talking about, Pete, is like, it's just, it's not like a part of success. It's like essential to your success as a player and a human being. You got to experience some of that. Hey, I didn't get what I wanted. What do I got to do? So that we deal with that, but I like that part. That's my favorite part about it, is helping the kids who are having a hard time. That's where you really see a lot of growth emotionally from them.
It reminds me of the Dodgers. You know, I mean, it used to be the Dodger way, you know, and everybody was taught the same from the, you know, the minor system. And then, you know, and similar to now too, I mean, everybody's taught the same. And that way, when you get to varsity, everything's, you know, pretty understandable. The players understand what they're getting into. Let's jump to this. Let's jump to Keenan. Interesting to find out why you got into coaching.
I wasn't very good at economics.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever got more than a B minus in my major. So I majored in econ. I just, you know, I did it because I thought I was supposed to do it. So I really just wanted to be a baseball coach. So after after I graduated from McAllister, I actually got a I got an offer to play for the Fargo Moorhead Redhawks in the Northern League. Mm-hmm. So I did that for like a really brief. So my stint as a professional baseball player was short lived and not illustrious. But I did do that for a little bit. And after I was done with that, then I went back to coach college. I didn't know what else to do. And I really wanted to be a small college baseball coach, you know, division two, division three, whatever opportunity came. And so I kind of mentored under my head coach at McAllister, Matt Parrington, who's an amazing, amazing guy, amazing coach, really taught me the meaning of like, hey, if you want to get the most out of your players, you've got to care about each and every one of them. Him and Coach Pal Eldridge from Punahou, really, that's what they were all about. And so I was like, hey, you know what? I love baseball. I don't really know anything else. I might as well try to be a coach. And so I did that. But then I realized that if I wanted to move back to Hawaii, there really, you know, there's only one real, well, there's two real baseball coaching jobs back here is University of Hawaii and University of Hawaii Hilo. And we have Hawaii Pacific University too, but that's not necessarily like a full-time job. And so I thought, well, okay. If I want to move home, I got to do something else. And I had some buddies who were pilots and they're like, you know, if you're not doing anything, you might as well go to flight school. So I went to flight school and became a pilot.
What do you love about coaching?
What I love about coaching. I love the game, obviously, but I really love the process of figuring out how to get the best out of the players and coaches by way of implementing the culture and a practice plan and just culture building. And a lot of that work, I can't take credit for that. I mean, the school does an amazing job. And all of what we do is like, I don't really have any original ideas. It's just like regurgitated stuff that we've molded into our brand of baseball and program. And it's all the guys that came before us. So, you know, whenever we're on it, we have a TV game and they televise the games. Every time we have like a playoff game or a championship game, I get like 100 calls and texts from former alumni and stuff. They're like, hey, you know, go get them tonight. And so we're really lucky to have that support. And I think it means so much to us at our alma mater that I just feel compelled to do the best I can for all the guys that, you know, that we did it with.
Well, I'll tell you what, I love that. Maybe these kids must be excited. They get to play on television. You know, your parents are probably all great parents, but we all know that, especially in high school baseball here in the U.S., that, you know, you're going to have issues with parents at times. Mm-hmm. What are some of the rules you set prior to the season with your parents? Discuss that a little bit, because things are kind of changing a little bit on how coaches are dealing with parents.
Yeah. We kind of have, I think the first thing to remember is it's not anybody's fault that they love their kids irrationally and unconditionally. I mean, that's, I think when you, and I only really realized that once I became a parent is how ridiculous, crazy you get about your kids and about anybody who you deem is treating them unfairly. And that having kids is probably the best thing that ever happened to my coaching career, just from the perspective of having empathy for that situation that you're talking about, like when they're upset. So I think the first thing that happens when we get a parent who's irate or upset is to just be like, hey, I feel you, I hear you, and thank you for bringing it up. And before they do that though, the rule is I won't talk to any parent until the kid has talked to me first. So if the kid hasn't advocated for themselves, then I will respectfully decline the conversation. So, you know, we don't want to rob them of an opportunity for them to stick up for themselves. And it's really hard for them to do it. and the kids are really brave. So I don't get twisted when a kid is like, hey, coach, how come I'm not playing? Like, dude, thank you for saying something. Because if you're not going to stick up for yourself, then nobody's going to stick up for you. So if they do that, then I'll have a conversation with the parents, and then we'll just try to have a meeting of the minds. And I think that contrary to popular belief, I don't think parents are like trying to grease the wheels to get their kid to start or make the team. I think they just want them to have a fair shot. And when they feel like they're not getting a fair shot, that's when they get upset, and rightly so.
Yeah. So. And the flip side of that too, during games, you know, I mean, parents, I don't blame them. You know, it's tough to watch your kid maybe have a bad game. Right. What's your advice as a parent too? What's your advice to coaches, parents out there? You know, when a player, you know, didn't have a great game, maybe, you know, struck out a few times and, you know, swung at some bad pitches, whatever the situation may be, but now they're going home with that parent. What's your advice to the parents on how to deal with the player on that kind of ride home?
Yeah. I mean, this has been all over social media, but you know, it makes sense. Like, hey, just tell them, I love to watch you play. Mm-hmm. And if they want to talk about it, then great. And we call it, for my little kids, we call it hustles and hugs. Like, hey, run around, play as hard as you can. And I don't care if you strike out 4 times and make 5 errors or walk the park. I still love you, and I'm going to give you a hug. So at least at the youth level, I believe in like practice hard, train them hard, coach them hard, love them hard. And then when they get to the game, just let them play. You know, you're supposed to do your work in practice. You shouldn't be, you know, yelling at a kid to throw strikes in the game. Like that's probably the least helpful thing you could ever say to a pitcher. But as far as the ride home, I think it's different for different kids. When they're young, hey, tell them you love them. And where are we going to go get ice cream? And they get older into like 7th, 8th grade. Now you can start to have a more meaningful conversation about, hey, what went well? What needs work? How are you going to do it? And then if a high school kid can't handle it, then he's going to be like, oh yeah, you know what? I should have swung at this pitch on 1 and 2 or whatever. I should have located my fastball there. The pitch sequence is off, whatever. So it just, you got to tailor it to the age of the player, I think.
You know, the other thing is I had a tough time early on with this as a coach during a game. You know, I wanted to talk a lot, you know, help players. And there's that fine line because there's only so much a player can listen to during a ball game. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously if they're hitting, you know, we tell our coaches, you know, you don't say anything, let them hit. But talk about that process throughout the game. What should that look like in some ways?
Yeah, I think you go over the plan before the game. And as you know, as the adage goes, good hitters make adjustments at bat to a bat, and great hitters make adjustments pitch to pitch. So they need to be doing that themselves. Mm-hmm. If they need a reminder, which they often do, then, you know, somebody will tell them either before the at bat or I'm kind of weird. I coach first base and give signals from there. So I'm close to them and I can kind of remind them. And we have an agreement with the players like, hey, you know, if I say this, this is what this means. If I'm like pointing to right center and there's 2 strikes, it's like, hey, stay in, you know, don't give up on an off speed pitch, that kind of stuff. They kind of know what like the physical signals mean. But we try to, I'm probably guilty of not saying enough. I don't say a lot during the games technically, because they're in survival mode at that point. It just happens too fast. You got to do your work in practice and then just let it eat during the game.
I'm with you. I think if you prepare well, you know, you let them play, and then later on things that maybe, you know, you saw that need to be worked on, you can work on in the next practice. You know, I love the part about coaching first base, not only what you said, but also a lot of hitters, most hitters are right-handed hitters, and it's much easier to see and that they don't have to turn.
But, I never thought about it that way. Yeah, I do it because we do a lot of, we call a lot of audibles. Hmm.
Explain.
I give a lot of green lights. I think, you know, the major leagues probably wouldn't like it, but we do a lot of kind of like gut feeling stuff. We're watching a pitcher's tendencies. You have a sense of when you're on the field, you kind of have a sense of what a guy might throw in a certain count where you might not get that in the bench or at third base. Seeing it from the runner's perspective at first and being able to be like, hey, now might be a good time to go. I think the guys like that. It gives them some freedom. We like the green light. We like the green light because they have a little bit more conviction to steal that bag. So that's why we do it. I don't know if it's the right thing to do. I kind of just like being out there. And our third base coach, who's kind of like our co-head coach, he's really good at knowing when to send guys, which I'm always thinking about personnel changes and whatnot. It's hard for me to be at third and calling signals and working the lineup card. So we try to delegate to our strengths.
Yeah. Great points. Now, are you fortunate enough that you also have a coach on the bench?
Yeah, we have like a football squad of coaches, Matt, because we got a lot of alumni and a lot of people who want to help. And they're all like teammates of mine from high school or guys that we've coached with or been coached by for years. So we got tons of guys on the bench.
So you got your responsibilities at first. You got the third base coach responsibilities. They know mm-hmm. theirs. What's the responsibility of the bench coach there?
He's telling a guy, hey, you know, in two or three batters, this guy's coming up, start swinging a bat, you know, typical bench coach stuff. Sometimes it's crowd control. If the guys start acting like idiots, then they've got to tell them to quiet down. And a lot of it is probably them second guessing what I'm calling out at first base.
Are there times, I don't know. Sometimes I think, when you have a coach on the bench, and kids, I was a kid, you're a kid. There are times I wasn't paying attention. I should have been. Are there things that you guys might do at times to help them pay attention?
During the game or?
Yeah, they're on the bench. Practice. No, they're not playing. Any teaching going on or any education going on during the game with the guys on the bench with your coach?
Yeah, I think some of the guys like to do that. Like something happens, outfielder throws to the wrong bag or, they didn't execute on a long single and keep the batter runner from getting the second and they threw home or something like that. That happens. But to kind of build in a system that makes sure that everybody's somewhat engaged, we just simply try to keep less guys on our roster. Mm. And so everybody's an injury or a couple of bats away from getting in the game. So we try, and we came to this over the course of years. Like, we used to keep plenty of guys, and then there's, 15 guys sitting on the bench, and that's when your culture starts hurting, is when you got too many guys sitting on the bench. And so we keep a pretty lean roster on purpose. It's hurt us at times, but I think overall we have more consistent engagement from the players because they know, like, hey, I could get in anytime, so I better stay in the game.
I love that. And this is why I started the podcast, Keenan, because, there's always different ways to do things. And for coaches to listen, there's always another way to do it. But as they're listening, boy, there's so much education going on. We've got about 4 minutes. Sure. I want to address now something kind of outside the box, I guess. And that is, you're a pilot. And how long have you been a pilot?
20 some odd years.
Wow. Now talk about your training as a pilot, how that helped you in coaching possibly.
Oh, I mean, pretty much a direct correlation. It's just preparation. Proper preparation gives you the skills and the confidence you need to succeed and execute when you need it the most. And on the baseball field, that's easy. It's an at bat, it's a ground ball, it's a fly ball, it's a pitch that you need to throw over the plate. That's pretty visceral example of, like, hey, everybody's watching, you got to perform. The difference is that's not life or death,
right?
Right. So, being at war, having bullets fly over your head, that's like real adversity. The baseball is like, it's just perceived adversity. And an airplane, when you're landing an airplane with a 30 knot crosswind on a short runway that's wet with 150 people in the back, that's real pressure. And the only way that you give yourself the skills and the confidence you need to execute in the moment, one, it's breath awareness. That, for me anyway, it's just remaining present and not getting domed up by, like, oh, what if I crash? That's not a really productive place to keep your mind. Just as it's not a productive thing for a pitcher to say, I have to throw a strike, or a hitter to say, I have to get a hit. The best thing you can do is remain present so you can access all of your training. There's a guy that is the director of player development for the Seattle Mariners, a guy named Andy McKay, who I follow on, Twitter. He has no idea who I am, but I've been a fan of his for years. And he gave a talk at the ABCA convention years ago, and it's a simple math equation. It's ability minus distractions equals performance. So ability minus distractions equals your performance. In practice, right, we got caged BP All-Americans all the time, right? There's no pressure. There's no distractions. There's no, I got to get a hit. There's no scouts. There's no playoff game. There's no, I got to do anything. So your ability if you have no distractions, right? If distractions are zero equals your performance. That's why we play so well in practice. As soon as you get into the game, you've got, I got to get a hit. It's hot. The ball's wet. I'm 0 for 4. I walk the last guy. So the more those distractions mount up, just like in flying, the more it's like, oh my God, it's windy, it's rainy, there's 150 people in the back. You've got to find a way to eliminate those distractions so that all your training that you've done, which is your ability, which is fixed in any given situation, right? You're not going to get better at, in this at bat. Can't do more BP, can't do more T work, can't lift any more weights. Your ability's fixed in that particular contest in that pitch. Your ability's fixed for this landing. So how do you perform well? Well, you just have to figure out a way to eliminate distractions and remain present. And so we work a lot on breath work. We work a lot on awareness and just present focus to eliminate those distractions.
You know, you mentioned the word distractions. It's a great way to end the show. Mentioned distractions probably four times at least. Talk about some of the distractions you put in your practice that allow you to create that good result.
Sorry, say that one more time. What was the question?
Talk about the distractions that you may place within your practice that could help your players get good results. So when they're hitting, what are you doing to distract them?
Oh, how do you simulate distractions? Yeah, one thing we do is we keep stats. We didn't do a good job of that this year. And it kind of showed. We didn't hit as well as we have in the past. And that was on me. So that's my fault. But when there's stats being kept in the cage, it matters. And when you tell them, hey, look, you know, the bats off the bench are going to be determined by your quality at bat percentage in this cage, then all of a sudden it adds an element of pressure. We like to have the pitchers who are done with their conditioning and their J-bands to come down and talk smack to the hitters. That's kind of fun. And we have an infield coach who is my infield coach, who is a hammer. And so the constant critiquing and loud coaching that he gives provides an element of pressure for those guys. So it's hard to simulate. I mean, you could simulate as much as you want, but there's nothing like a real game. The only way you could do it is to just prepare well and fake it till you make it, so that in the game you have enough preparation that you're like, okay, I should be confident here. And the more times you execute, then it just turns into like legitimate confidence. So
yeah, and I think that you said it right. That's the biggest challenge, and that is trying to simulate the real situation. I mean, we can do our best and hope that it works. And I'll tell you what, Keenan, this is fantastic. Great show. Love it. Can't thank you enough for being on the show. I know your season's still going on, right? So I want to wish you.
It's done. It's done. We finished a couple weeks ago, last week. Can't remember. Yeah.
So what's next?
Summer baseball, man. No rest for the weary. So we've got our younger guys. This is the fun part. This is the part where they develop. This part where they work on things that they can't in the spring because they're just trying to compete. So now we can kind of dial it back and work on some individual player development.
Fantastic. All right, man. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Pete. Appreciate it, man. Thanks for what you do.
All right, folks. That is Keenan Suwei, and remember, from Punahou High School in Honolulu. And special thanks to ESPN Honolulu again. Folks, thanks for joining us. I'm Pete Caliendo. I'm the host of Baseball Outside the Box. Don't forget, go to baseballoutsidethebox.com for the audio. Go to YouTube, Peter Caliendo, for the visual aspect. And don't forget, folks on Facebook, thanks for joining us there. And we will see all of you on tomorrow's show. Remember, stay safe, be healthy. God bless you, and we'll see you on the baseball field soon. See you later, folks.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.